want your soul.
I'm a trained counselor who has helped countless drug addicts and alcoholics come back from the brink of death. I believe fully in Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and the 12-step program. The full acceptance of these steps and the meaning that comes from believing in a higher power has created literally miracles in front of my eyes. I have seen homeless alcoholics who were months away from dying, shaking wretches of people with jaundiced eyes and wet brain. But after a year of AA and sobriety, they were some of the most confident, happy, and spiritual people I had ever known. They would give you the shirt off their back, and they constantly volunteered to save others from the brink of death. Some of them became staples of their community, devoted church members and deacons, entrusted with large sums of money, and not one of them I knew ever betrayed the trust of the community after their recovery. AA and NA gave their lives meaning, and over time, sometimes gave them almost total inner peace. But during the recession caused by the global COVID pandemic, I lost my job. I became desperate and applied to hundreds of jobs, absolutely anything related to counseling or helping addicts. And then one day, I got a phone call. "Hello, may I please speak to Jonathan?" the deep male voice said on the other end of the line. "Speaking," I said. "Hi there, Jonathan. My name is Winston. I work for a company that is seeking highly qualified counselors such as yourself. Would you be interested in coming in for an interview?" he asked. While I was fairly desperate, I also knew that I had to ask the most important question for any potential job. How much is the starting pay, if you don't mind me asking?" I said bluntly. Winston chuckled slightly. "It's $80,000 a year," he said. I smiled inwardly, excited about the new prospect. Most of the drug and alcohol counselors around New England made far less than that, despite the fact that the job required a college degree and years of schooling. We made plans to meet, and I went in for the interview and was hired on the spot. I was to begin immediately. Winston was a mountain of a man, at least 6'6", with a shaved head and tattoos all over his body. His muscles looked like they had been sculpted out of marble, but he was also quite nice, smiling and laughing all the time as he showed me around the counseling building. As we neared the end of the tour, he brought me to a room in the basement where a sign had been posted on the door that said, "Meeting in progress. Come in." He pushed the door open slowly, and I saw a room composed of all men, most of them white. They sat in chairs that faced the podium at the front, and a man was speaking there. "Thanks to this program, I've been clean for 6 months now," he said sheepishly. He was a small man with huge glasses, balding brown hair, and a pudgy belly. "I never thought it was possible, but with the grace of God and the help from all of you, I've done it. I've done the impossible. I've stopped killing people and women. I barely even get the craving anymore, and when I do, I call my sponsor, and he is there before I know it, taking the gun or knife out of my hands and talking me down before I can go through with it. It really helps because I know he knows what it's like. All the anger, the rage, the feelings of being so small. He's been there before. He's known what it felt like to want to choke a bitch and fuck her, and then cut her insides out, and then fuck her again. Having someone who knows what that feels like, that desire, it's a miracle. Growing up, if I ever talked about my feelings, my dad, he would beat me. He'd put me in the hospital, even broke my nose a couple times. Another time, when I was 7, he put me in a coma for a week, fractured my skull in 2 places. So I learned pretty quickly not to talk about my feelings. Never cry or complain. I just bottled up everything inside until it exploded. Nods of agreement and solidarity passed through the room. Winston led me over to a chair in the back of the room and had me sit down. I took a minute to take this all in, and I thought about what the man had said. It seemed ridiculous. Was he really talking about killing people to a group of fellow addicts? I had no idea what to think. I had heard confessions in AA from people who had hit pedestrians with their cars and left the scene without stopping, due to them being drunk and afraid to go to prison, but this was totally different. The man then finished his story, and the apparent leader of the group, a tall black man with a shaved head, got up in front of the group. "Okay, well, thank you for sharing, Douglas," the man said. Douglas went and sat down. I looked at the name tag on the man's shirt. It read, "Hi, my name is King." King reached into a cloth bag next to the podium, pulling out some round circular coins that I recognized instantly as sobriety chips. And as usual, at the end of every meeting, we like to hand out chips that recognize people's lengths of sobriety, King said in a deep baritone, smiling widely, his face friendly and unassuming. "For Leon, we have a 10-year sobriety chip," King yelled, and everyone in the room stood up applauding. A nondescript elderly white man got up from the center of the room, smiling sheepishly as he went to the front, shaking King's hand and taking his token. "For Douglas, we have a 6-month sobriety chip." The pudgy man then got back up and went to the front of the room, taking the chip and sitting back down. "And last but not least, Anton, we have a 24-hour chip." A white man with a goatee got up and grabbed his chip. "The first 24 hours are always the hardest, as we all know," King said, and the room murmured in agreement. "One day at a time, though, that's all we can do." The meeting then ended with a serenity prayer, and everyone began to disperse. I then turned to Winston. You know, I'm a little confused," I said, and he laughed, a deep, rich sound that echoed across the room. "This is a newer group, a 12-step program for those addicted to murder, serial killing, anything like that. We have found that with drugs and alcohol, prison doesn't really help reform these poor addicts. They don't get any of the professional or psychological help they need while they're incarcerated. So we started a group here instead, if you see what I mean."
Right. Yeah, I mean, I see what you mean, I guess. I mean, I feel like they should be in prison, though. These guys actually kill people?" I was horrified, and he nodded.
"Well, they used to. Some of them have been in recovery for decades. Some of them are brand new at it, and this is what we hired you for, to work with these men, to help save lives, and to keep them on the straight and narrow." He nodded as if to himself. "It won't be an easy job, surely, but that's why you're getting paid more than other counselors in the area. I'm sure you're up for a challenge, right?" I had to think about it. I really didn't know if I was up for a challenge of this caliber. I mean, drugs and alcohol, that's a little different. If they get an inkling and they want to get high, they just go do it. If one of these guys get an inkling, they might kill me. I had to take a second to think about this. But then again, what other job prospects did I have? I needed the money to pay my rent. Otherwise, my 17-year-old daughter and I could end up on the streets. I sighed and nodded. "All right, yeah, I'm up for it." And I agreed. Blood covered the floor of the room in front of me. I looked from Leon with his white hair and wrinkled face to the barely recognizable mass of blood and organs on the floor. I'm sorry, Mr. Jonathan," he said, crying into his hands. "I had a moment of weakness and I relapsed. I don't know what happened. It was totally fine 1 minute, and then this idiot came out of nowhere. He cut me off in traffic and he flipped me off for no reason. I had to slam on my brakes to avoid hitting him. Can you believe that? So I followed him, really just to ask for an apology, but instead he started swearing at me, calling me all these horrible names, and I just kind of blacked out. I thought about killing him. I don't know." Tears ran down his cheeks. I walked over to him, taking the bloody knife from his right hand carefully. He let it go without a fight. Yeah, it's okay, Leon, I said, patting him on his thin shoulder. Relapsing is a part of the healing process. All we can do is figure out what went wrong this time so we can work harder next time to prevent this from happening again. 10 years of sobriety down the drain, he screamed, falling to his knees, getting blood all over his blue jeans. Did you have sex with him too, Leon? Yeah, I did everything. I couldn't help it. I sighed, backing up to the entrance of the room and called Winston. Yeah, I might need a little more help here on the basement level of the counseling building. Leon had a relapse and he's not in a good state. Do you know who the sponsor is? We need to call them. After cleaning up the scene, I was talking to King and Winston about Leon. Why did he bring his victim here to the counseling building, do you think? I asked. And they shrugged. Ah, this is where they're comfortable, King said, shrugging. This is where they have friends and can talk openly. Maybe they just instinctively come back here during times of the struggle. I really don't know. Just then, my phone started ringing. I looked down to see the name of my daughter on the screen, Becky. I went out into the hallway and answered it. Hey, Becky, honey, what's up? I'm at work right now, I said, and she sighed. Dad, do you know a guy named Douglas? She asked, and a chill ran down my spine. Yeah, I do. Why do you ask? I said, my voice rising in pitch. I could feel my heart speeding up in my chest. Something felt very wrong about this phone call. Well, he's here. He's asking for you, she said. I gasped. Becky, I want you to get far away from him. Call the police, get the gun out of the cabinet in my room, lock the door, and stay there until the cops arrive. You got it? But somebody else responded. Hi, Jonathan, a male voice said through the cell phone. You have a very pretty daughter, by the way. I think I'm going to enjoy this. Get away from my daughter, you sack of shit, I screamed into the phone, and Douglas laughed. Then I heard a gunshot, and the line went dead. I started sprinting through the building towards the parking lot outside. My house was only a 5-minute drive from the counseling building, and I prayed I could get there in time. Please, God, let her be alive, I wailed, running as fast as I could. I ran into the house, seeing a trail of blood leading from the living room to the basement. I gasped in horror. Visions of Becky's dead body shoved into a barrel or cut into pieces with a chainsaw flipped through my mind in rapid succession. I followed the trail of blood to the basement where the light was on, and what I saw there shocked me. Becky was standing over the dead body of Douglas. She was cutting off his head with a bandsaw, whistling to herself, an angelic smile on her smooth, placid face. There was a drain in the basement floor, and she let the blood flow down it as she cut the body into pieces, throwing each piece into a plastic barrel. Becky! What the fuck are you doing? I yelled. She turned around, a look of happiness and bliss in her eyes. Just something I enjoy doing, Daddy, she said, smiling widely. He's not my first, you know. You had nothing to fear. Once I saw this loser sneaking around in our backyard, scoping out the house, I just went to your room and grabbed your gun, hiding it in my hoodie. He thought he was so smart, but really, he was the easiest kill I've ever had. She laughed. I quickly walked over to her, embracing her in a hug. I'm glad you're alive, I said, tears beginning to drip down my face. My vision turning blurry as a wave of emotions overtook me. The next week, I was heading to work, Becky in the passenger seat. She was complaining as teenagers often do. I don't see why I have to go to these stupid groups, she yelled. Look, you have an addiction problem. I know you don't know it yet. Teenagers never realize it. Hell, even adults is often in denial about the problems. Becky, I just want you to go talk to these people,
See if you can't relate to what they're saying. You've said you've killed what? 4 people already? And she nodded glumly. I'm just worried about you, sweetie, okay? I don't want this addiction to take over your life and ruin it. You're too smart for that. You could easily go to college or be a doctor or an engineer or anything you want. But not if you let this addiction ruin your life. She then let out a grunt of exasperation. All right, fine, I'll go. Will you be with me in there, though? Always, I said. I'll always be there. No matter what.